Welcome to Coffee and Change, a podcast where we talk about change in our lives, our work, and our world, and how we're managing it.
On this episode, I'm going to try something a little different. Calling it Flip the Script, I've invited a frequent listener to interview me and ask me about change. I hope you enjoy.
Hi there, my name is Khalil Samani. I'm an experience consultant in our customer experience practice at West Monroe Partners. And I've been a longtime fan and follower of the Coffee and Change podcast that Bill does. I've listened to it for a long time and have come up with a lot of questions as I was listening. And one day I decided to ask Bill some of those questions that I had on my mind. And we had some good conversations. And this idea eventually came up to flip the script a little bit and have me interview Bill and get some of his insights on all these questions involving change and change in our lives and change at West Monroe and in industry and in our jobs. So welcome, Bill.
And, thank you.
Excited to have you here.
It feels good to be on this side of the microphone.
Sure, yeah.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, awesome. Why don't we get started and have you tell us for once a little bit about yourself, your history with West Monroe and sure. Your history with this podcast and kind of why you decided to do this in the first place.
Sure. Yeah. I think, it's kind of great to think about this almost, you know, a year or more into this. And I was actually talking with a friend of mine who, runs a podcast, called Curiosity.
Okay.
And he's sort of in season two of his podcast, and it made me think a little bit around, I think this might be the first episode of season two, of this podcast. So a little bit about my background and how do I arrived at having this podcast. Obviously I think folks know at West Monroe, I lead our organizational change management practice here on the West Coast. Additionally to that, I focus now in something I call digital change. So if you think about a lot of the digital strategy and digital transformation that our clients and customers are going through, that starts with change. And at the heart of anything digital transformation or strategy-wise is change management. So I'm getting to focus a lot on that. So that's what I do kind of day in, day out. How this podcast came about, it's actually kind of a great story. When I previously worked in, before West Monroe, I was actually at the University of Washington. And I was the first change management person they had ever brought on staff there. And I was helping or trying to help a lot of people go through some pretty significant change. And I realized that, you know, I would meet and have meetings or do demos with people. And there would be groups of people, and I would talk about the change curve, what that was like, how to mitigate risk. And a lot of people would get it, but then individually they'd come up to me and they'd say, I'm struggling with it. I don't really understand it. I'm worried about it. And so I would say to them, hey, you know what? Let's just go grab a cup of coffee and let's talk through it.
Sure.
And so in the process of that, I would sit down with them, I would grab a cup of coffee, and we would just talk about, like, what are you worried about? What are you excited about? What do you need more answers on? And it became very approachable. It became a little more proximal. And it didn't seem so burdensome to them. So what I ended up doing was using that as a tool. I would just say to people, let's go grab a cup of coffee and let's talk about the change in your life or in the world or in your work and let them drive the conversation. What ended up happening was many of them left those conversations much more empowered, enabled, and ready for the change. So I thought, hey, those were very successful, but why should I keep that just between two people?
Sure.
Like the conversation like we're having today is great, but it's even greater if you can share it with the world and other people can listen to it, like yourself, listening to the previous podcast, and gain a lot of insight and wisdom. So that's how the podcast came about. And when I was here at West Monroe, one of the things I said was, I'd love to start this. And they said, do it. And here we are today.
Well, we are all lucky to have you here and to have your insights and through this podcast. So I'm very glad for that. So you talked about the University of Washington a little bit.
Yeah.
Previous to West Monroe. How, even before that, how did you get interested in change management? Or where did that interest get sparked from?
Yeah, it's a great question that I get asked a lot. Obviously, we do a lot of recruiting here at West Monroe. We're growing quite a bit. And in the interviews, a lot of times people say, how did you get into change management? And I think I may have mentioned in a previous episode with a guest who used to work with me at IBM back in the day. I don't think I found change management. I think it found me, sure. is what I usually tell people. Because change management itself has gone through an evolution over the past decade plus. It wasn't always called change management by certain people. Sometimes it was called business transformation. Sometimes it was communications plus. Sometimes it was communications and training. At the heart of all of it, really, though, was there was always a group of people that, frankly, needed a little bit of support, be it coaching or, through practice or tips or just some perspective, frankly, on, hey, things are going to be okay. We'll get through it. You know, we're going to get to where we need to be in the future. And so because I think I took a very pragmatic and I would also say optimistic approach to things, I found myself on a lot of projects at IBM that involved me working with a group of people that were, frankly, struggling, whether it was through some negotiation or some system or some policy. They were really resistant, and I would come in and I would just talk to them like regular people, and we would brainstorm and we'd get creative, and I would validate people's worries or their thoughts, and I would focus in on behavior change. And before you knew it, people would say, wow, you ran a really great meeting. Can you do this one? And then that meeting led to another meeting and led to a project and led to a program. And so before I knew it, I was leading change initiatives. And it was at that time, early in my career, in my consulting career at least, that I thought, hey, I should probably look into what some of the stuff is that I'm doing. And that's how I kind of found it. And the opportunities came fast and furious. The great thing about doing this type of work is it always leads to more work. So if you do a really good job, and sometimes a good job means you encounter a lot of resistance. Mm-hmm. That's okay. I want people to know that. It usually leads to follow-on work because people are so appreciative that you spend the time with them, that you help them work through their fears and work into their hopes, and you help them see a clear picture of the future. If you can do that for people, they will absolutely sing your praises and say, hey, you know what? You should go talk to this person because they could really use your help. And so one project led to another project, led to a program, led to, you know, transformation, led to all sorts of opportunities. And that's how, I think that's how it found me.
Wow. Awesome. And, you know, it sounds like a lot of that, a lot of your success in change management and in those various initiatives and conversations you've had started out with, you know, a cup of coffee or, mm-hmm. or listening to someone or listening to someone's fears and hopes,
right.
Empathizing with them. Is there something to be said about empathy and change management, or is empathy the root of change management?
It's a great question. I think there's a lot of really, really brilliant people that have been trying to figure that out for many years. I'll go out on a limb and say it's a huge part of it. The first, I can sort of tip my hat to our first podcast guest, was Shauna Saffel. And Shauna Saffel and I both work on this team here at West Monroe. And, part of the reason we both love our jobs in change management, and I think part of the reason we both do really well at our jobs, is because our greatest strength, according to Strength Finders, is empathy. And when I took the test, I took that StrengthFinders sort of, I don't want to call it a test, it's more like a survey. I took it in 2010, and I also retook it in 2018.
Oh, interesting.
And there was some change in that, but what was interesting was the top strength, empathy, was consistent across both. And that really told me that, to answer your question, yes, that is the skill and strength that I use the most in doing this work. How that plays itself out and what that looks like every single day, you hit the nail on the head. You said, does it mean going to meet somebody for a cup of coffee or meeting people where they're at? And it's exactly it. It's listening, it's being curious, it's being genuine, and frankly, it's just meeting somebody where they're at. So try and understand what it's like for somebody, try and put yourself in their shoes, ask questions, be curious, come at something with inquiry, as opposed to necessarily like rigid methodology.
Sure.
And then oftentimes I don't necessarily have a set outcome in mind. If I can help people work through something and feel more at ease, that's success to me.
Sure. And that's really neat to hear, because I feel like a lot of times we walk into our conversations nowadays with an agenda. It's hard not to.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
We walk into our everyday lives with an agenda, or we break up with one. So coming in with an open mind and treating conversations like you were talking about is really neat to hear.
I think it's important to also call out that coming into a meeting or coming into, you know, a program or a project without set agenda, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that you're like turning your mind off, right? It doesn't mean that you're not doing work. In fact, I would argue you're doing more work because you're just using a different side of your brain.
Sure.
It requires a lot more reflection. It requires a lot more introspection. It requires, as I said before, a lot more curiosity. And so those are parts of your brain that light up in a different way than when you're prepping for a test or prepping for an agenda or focused on a set outcome. Because if it doesn't go that way, a lot of times you can respond with rigidity as opposed to resilience, you know, to the ability to bounce back or the ability to say, well, I wasn't expecting the conversation to go there, but since it did,
mm-hmm.
I'll follow it.
Sure.
Follow the thread where it goes. And to me, that's the part that I love about this job, is you discover so much about the human condition, and it's an honor to do that work.
For sure. Yeah, and speaking of the human condition, to talk about change management as it pertains to society or change in society, I'd love to know your thoughts on why do you think change is important to us today, in today's mm-hmm. world? Things, you know, in the news and in our everyday lives, there's so much change in work and in politics and the economy. And why is change important to us today?
You know, I think there's a couple different ways to look at this. You did hit on in your question, there's a lot of change coming at us mm-hmm. every single day. And I don't want to understate that. There is, just like every day, there is more and more data generated in the world. And, you know, you can look up the stats. I think I shared it in my previous podcast around just the, you know, amounts of data that are generated in a single minute or hour or day, you know, in today's day and age, far outdoes all of the data that was ever created for like thousands of years before,
not
right?
Not surprised.
And so if you think about that scale, that's just intimidating to begin with. But if you step back and you say, well, how does that present itself in your life every single day, right? We've got two laptops here. We've got a phone recording this. Mm-hmm. We've got a device. Like, these are all just things that are mechanisms with which we are bombarded by change. So technology is a piece that I'm happy to talk about because that's sort of in our world, right? We do technology consulting. We help others use technology to better their lives. I think it's important to understand that these are tools that can help you better your life, but they are also tools that can make you feel very inundated and overwhelmed. And as you talked about the amount of change, I think there's a tremendous amount of change out there. Why it's important to understand is you as a person and for the human condition, you kind of need to set your own threshold, mm-hmm. essentially, and understand what is too much, what is just right, what is not enough. Now, that's going to change. That scale is going to change where you're at in your life and depending on how much is in your control versus not your control. Why I think it's important to talk about change is because change is survival. Like, if you go very Darwinian about it, right, it's survival. And if you don't change, you don't grow. And if you don't grow, chances are you may not survive, you know, depending on where you're at in the world. But it's also a very scary experience to grow and to change. And so part of having the discussions, to me, it's important because if people can't make sense of it, then it dominates them. It overwhelms them. And if you feel dominated by something or overwhelmed by something or inundated by something, then you're not sort of approaching your day-to-day in your best mental health, and that leads to physical health and spiritual health and everything else. So to me, I think it's an important conversation to have, but it's a conversation that doesn't necessarily result in the same answers for every single person.
Sure.
And that's okay. I would just rather people talk about it in whatever form and fashion they want, in whatever lens they want, so that I can play a small role in curating that conversation.
Sure. And you talked about technology specifically being, you know, many times an overwhelming aspect of our lives.
So right.
You talked about the phones and laptops and microphone, even in this room alone. So tell us a little bit more about that and why, maybe why technologies can be overwhelming and potentially some strategies to deal with that.
Sure. I mean, I think we get to play in the space a lot, and we're very fortunate in our lives and in our roles, in consulting, because we get access to technology probably more so than most do in their day to day. I think it's important to understand the role of technology as an enabler. I think I was reading the other day, the iPhone came out in 2007.
I think that's correct, yeah.
So it's been around for about a decade, right?
Wow.
Right, and you say, wow.
Yeah, that's
but you think to yourself, that's not a very long time. A decade or more. But this device has completely changed the way that humans interact, that humans walk through a city, that humans take transportation, that humans get information. And to me, that's great. That's a great enabler that we've got a pocket-sized computer that you can look up and you can get voting information and you can find out where it's safe to go and you can find out, where there might be a fire or what. Like, there's all of this that has at your fingertips, which to me is great. It's a great enabler and it's a great equalizer. I think why it's important to understand, like, where technology can be overwhelming is when it starts to feel like it is leading us as opposed to us leading our lives with it.
Sure.
Or, with it added. And really that's where it comes down to, attention and the ability to focus. And there are a lot of studies that people can go out and read. But when technology starts to feel like it's dictating our behavior, or we have to do it because of said technology, I think it becomes a dangerous equation a little bit. And so it requires, people like us to have conversations to say, great, that on its own is a wonderful technology, but how are you applying it? Like, when you put it in an organization, what does it do? When you put it in your home, what does it do?
Sure.
When you put it on the space station, what does it do, right? All three of those are unique examples. That could bring a lot of pluses and present a few minuses. You have to have a conversation about what that means. And everybody's take on that's going to be a little bit different. And so to me that, there's a lot that people, can do in their lives to just stop and think about how is technology benefiting your life? How is it possibly presenting itself with some, negative outcomes that you may not have thought of, and then make decisions based on that. Whether it's through work or through life, I try and revisit that conversation quite a bit. In fact, I'll be completely honest. I'm probably at a point where in the next year or so, I'm probably going to do some disengagement from a lot of social media.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think, if you look at the examples of Facebook, right? Facebook at a certain time in my life did wonderful things.
Sure.
I was a third culture kid who grew up around the world and moved a lot. And the concept of Facebook connecting me back with friends and, acquaintances and colleagues who otherwise I would have been, writing emails and letters to, it was great for a time in my life. I'm now to the point where I don't necessarily trust my data on that platform. And there's a lot of reasons that people can look up in the news and other places to inform that for themselves. I'm not getting value out of it anymore. It's actually presenting me with more stress and more anxiety and worry than it is presenting me with optimism, a sense of connection, and a sense of consistency. And so I'm trying to decipher and visit the decision as to whether or not I disengage from that sometime next year. So that's just a small example.
No, that's really interesting. It's good to hear that perspective. I think we've all thought about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Where is this data going? Is this something I want to keep, you know, contributing data to, whether it's advertent or inadvertent.
Mm-hmm. And is it leading you or are you leading
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Right?
It starts to be a little scary when you start thinking about it.
Right.
Yeah. I guess conversely, there's a lot of different dimensions of technology, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about functional dimensions and industry dimensions and the amount of technology in the world. I've heard a couple articles about a more spiritual dimension of technology. So this is a little esoteric here, but the thought is we have a moral obligation to increase the amount of technology in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's, I love the fact that you took it esoteric, a little philosophical, because I think sometimes I don't afford myself enough options to do that. But I will make a plug and a sort of a plug zone for a couple of my favorite podcasts where I think some of this may have sparked for you as well. There's a great podcast I listen to called On Being. And there's actually a section that the interviewer, her name is Krista Tippett, does. It's a little bit like what we're doing today.
Sure.
She actually did sort of a portion of the podcast called Living the Questions. And it was very similar to this, where they flipped the script and people asked her questions as someone who deals with this, the philosophical or some of the esoteric questions. And I think it's interesting, the moral obligation of technology comes up a lot in that podcast and specifically interviewing her guests. And I love the fact that it does, because those are the questions that kick around in my head a lot.
Yeah, sure.
And when somebody else is interviewing on a podcast with a guest I've never met, and chances are I might not ever cross paths with them before, but when their answer or their question is exactly what's been bouncing around in my head or an answer I'm trying to formulate somehow, it makes me feel not alone in the world. And so when she posed these questions around the moral obligation of technology, I was so happy, because I think to myself, look, technology is allowing us to do what we're doing today,
mm-hmm.
right? Technology is allowing us to reach other brains, other minds, other voices. Technology is frankly helping people live longer in many ways. So I would say that's a moral obligation to continue supporting that technology. But on the spiritual side, I think the thing that I get concerned about is the noise.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say noise, I mean from the standpoint, again, back to the bombardment of what is coming at us and our ability to focus and make informed decisions. I worry that we are putting a little bit of our experience on autopilot. I had a great experience the other day that I did with a chatbot. So I had ordered something specifically for Thanksgiving. And one of the people I'll be spending Thanksgiving with came back and had a question. They said, hey, I have an allergy to this particular grain. Do you know if these pies that you ordered had the grain in it? And I said, I don't, but let me check. So I went onto the website of said supplier, and that little chat thing popped up. And
sure.
I said, okay, well, this ought to be interesting, because I'm gonna ask a question. I know it's a chatbot, right? I know it's not a person.
Mm-hmm.
I asked the question. It was pretty complex about this one grain. I'm trying to look up an allergy information. And it came back with a script, which I knew it wasn't a person. But then quickly at some point it shifted over when once the technology realized that my question was probably more complex or more multi-threaded, I think they did pivot it over to a human being. And it was very noticeable when the human being was chatting with me as opposed
sure.
to the chatbot, because the context and the tone of their response was much more focused around, we wouldn't ever want to put someone in a position where they have an allergic reaction
mm-hmm.
over a holiday like Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So their empathy presented itself, right? And even though I was using technology to interact with this supplier, it became very evident to me in that moment that I am now getting empathy through this lens, which made me feel better, because I now felt like I had somebody on the other side who I had done business with saying, I am not only looking out for you, I'm looking out for your guests. Let me go get this information. What they ended up doing was they sent me an email separately with the exact ingredients, with pictures of the ingredients and the ingredients list there.
Really?
Which gave me assurance. And then I was able to send that on to that particular person and say, I assure you we're okay. And right? And to me, that like that could have been done a couple different ways, mm-hmm. but it started off in a place of technology, chatbot, awesome. It ended in a place of empathy and human connection because there was somebody on the other side saying, literally envisioning a person not wanting to have allergic reaction over a family holiday. I don't think you can replace that with technology.
Sure.
So to me, that's a spiritual and a moral obligation around how do you use technology to better the human experience.
And I feel like those interactions, like with chatbots and soon to be, you know, AR and VR are becoming more and more common.
Right.
Our interactions with technology as opposed to a human being.
Right.
So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on, as we interact more and more with technology, how do we continue to bring that human empathy in? With a chatbot, I can see how getting kicked to a person with a complex answer.
Yeah.
But I do feel like we're trending more and more away from having that human there.
Yeah. I mean, this probably falls a little bit in your line of study and work as well. I think it goes back down to human-centered design. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a chance to meet with one of our colleagues earlier this week who's down in LA, and her entire background is on human-centered design and, you know, designing systems and processes and experiences, frankly, that are centered around the human condition. And to me, I think that's the power of coming at this work. Yes, the technology can save us time. Yes, the technology can probably save us money. But I think if you lose sight of that human-centered design, that question, what are we really trying to solve? Or the question I would phrase is, how are we bettering the world? Like, how are we improving the human condition? Mm-hmm. If you start there and then you do offshoots, I think you stay in the lanes of this moral obligation of technology.
Sure.
But if you don't start there and you go down this path, it's very hard to get back there. Hmm. I think you can get very lost in the excitement and the, possibilities of things. And then it becomes about the thing and not how it's affecting you and me.
Sure. That's a great perspective, actually. That's going to get me thinking a little bit. So I guess it can be hard to step back and realize how far we've come with technology in general.
Yeah.
And even to get to this point where we can have a conversation about being esoteric with technology or the spiritual dimension of technology. So, over the course of your career, how have you seen technology change for the better or worse and get to this point where it is today that we're discussing?
You know, I would say, over the course of my career, I've definitely seen a lot of technology change. I think I have chosen to probably focus it more on the for the better, and maybe that's because I'm sort of a glass half full kind of guy. I definitely see how it can be used. Let's put it this way. I think it can be designed with the best of intentions. It can land with the worst of impacts.
Mm.
And I'll give an example that, again, I read about recently. There was a company that was running sort of their initial recruiting screen using an AI, algorithm, if that's the appropriate term. And so essentially what this algorithm was doing was trying to go through and look at the best qualities of the top performers in this organization.
Oh, interesting.
And then do essentially through machine learning and a screen of resumes that were coming in and do the initial cut, right? What ended up happening was it ended up hiring a lot of what they already had. Well, I should say it ended up advancing a lot of candidates that were anything but diverse.
Sure.
And so what they realized in the process, a little too late, was this machine learning, this algorithm, this AI, was designed by the people that were already in the organization. And so what ended up happening was it was unconscious bias that was built into the technology. So if I'm designing a technology with my view of the world, well, naturally, it's probably going to go out and seek and pull people that are like-minded, because I would say this is what success looks like. That, to me, was not a good use of the technology. It was probably short-sighted. Best of intentions, right? Let's let the technology do it in an objective way.
Sure.
Removing bias from the equation. Because these things, right, don't have hearts and minds and souls. They should be unbiased. But if we design them with bias, unintentionally, it still has the same impact on the world.
Sure.
And so that's a small example to me where the technology did not do better for society. And if you take that example, you can find those every single day. There's a great podcast out there called Invisibilia, and it talks about how technology is used in a certain way to sort of favor those that already used it or designed it. And what about those that are sort of invisible still? And there's some great episodes there where, you know, you listen to them and you think about the way they use technology. And if somebody had different challenges, had different, limitations, would they get the same result out of it? And most of the time the answer is no. And then you ask yourself, is that fair? So to me, it's about equanimity. And that's you got to focus on that in order to keep it positive. I also think there's, to get really esoteric about it, you could say there's a lot of technology being used out there, drones, that are being used for bad outcomes. Some good, some bad. That's, again, part of the human condition. It can be used for good and for evil.
Well, I love that you talked about unconscious bias and how that affects how we, maybe infects too, build and create our technology and the purpose and the effect that technology has on the world as a result of what we put into it. Speaking of unconscious bias, I know you are very actively involved in inclusion and diversity at West Monroe. So right. I'd love to hear a little bit more about why you're passionate about IND, how you kind of got involved in the IND space, and what you do with IND at West Monroe, or why it's important.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess to start off with the why, like why inclusion and diversity? Why am I passionate about it? I've had the experience of, growing up in a world where I lived around the world. I got to learn many languages, live in many cultures, and really broaden and see the beauty in the world and all of its cultures and flavors and voices and perspectives very early on. And so I was very fortunate in that, and it made me who I am today. And I've also had the opportunity working through the military or going to the schools that I went to or working on the teams that I've been working on. I've seen it in action every single day that when you bring people of diverse perspectives, diverse backgrounds, diverse upbringings, ways of life, levels of creativity, you bring them together with the intention of creativity or innovation or just challenging the status quo. Mm-hmm. You put those people together and you just say, here is a challenge, go do it. You're going to come out with amazing results. I've also seen and been in places where they put you in a group of people that are just like you, had the same education, had the same access, had the same, socioeconomic upbringing, and you don't get such great outcomes. You get a lot of the same. You get a lot of groupthink. You get a lot of baked-in bias. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen it change cultures. I've seen it change lives. I've seen it change outcomes. And once you've seen it, it's hard to unsee it. Once you've been affected by it, it's hard to not want to be, around it. So personally and professionally, I've seen it enacted a great deal. I had an opportunity here at West Monroe to be a part of that journey. When they brought me on 3 years ago, I talked to them during my interview about how I was very, very focused on inclusion and diversity, how in my own upbringing and life and through the military and, you know, being a gay man and the adversities that I had faced, but the resiliency that I had built in the process, and frankly, the beauty that comes out of all of that. And I told them that this is important to me. I helped, you know, grow parts of an organization previously that way. I help students in universities with this. I help parents. It's just something that I would do, you know, anyway and any day, as I say. And they said, that's great. You know, we're at a place where we are really, really hoping to scale this and do this right. Will you help us do it? And so I absolutely said yes. And we've grown in a very impressive inclusion diversity council here at West Monroe. We're a relatively young company. We're 15, 16 years old. And so, but we're taking some, you know, I think some bold positions on what inclusion is and what belonging feels like. And it's just an honor to be a part of that. And I would say it's even more of an honor to get to live that out in our client spaces as well. I think now our clients are starting to listen to our own experience and say, hey, how are you doing this? You know, you and I both work in the tech world and in the consulting world. And those are two places that struggle a lot with, I don't want to say they struggle with inclusion per se. I think they do struggle, like we were just talking about before, with diversity, right? Mm-hmm. How do you go get diverse minds and diverse talent? You got to go to different places. You got to meet people where they're at, going all the way back to what we started with, right? All of those things require a different approach, a different perspective. And for me, that's why I'm so passionate about it. I see the results. I see change happen every single day in the world. And I think it happens in a more momentous and memorable way when you have diversity and you're inclusive and people have a sense of belonging. They can do their best work. I mean, if you feel like you belong to a community and you're supported, you're not worrying about certain things. And that doesn't take energy away from you. And then you can direct that energy into other things like creating or brainstorming or innovating.
Sure. And I've read, you know, study after study that shows that, you know, our teams do better when they're diverse or mm-hmm. when they're inclusive and, you know, performance is better. Financially, there's yep. a better return. So that's, you know, that's very interesting to hear. And especially what you were talking about in terms of change, change and IND in the tech space and in our project space. So it can be difficult, and I've seen many situations where there's not a lot of diversity, like you were talking about, and it can feel uncomfortable in that space. And as consultants, we have a duty to our clients.
Yeah.
That's where we live, and that's our bread and butter. So
right.
A question about that, how do you approach a non-inclusive space or a space that doesn't make you personally feel safe or someone else in feel safe? How do you approach that, especially in a client situation?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of my sort of my go-to approach to it is to start off by not making assumptions. So it's a very hard thing to do, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think we're coded. And we're sort of, a lot of times it's projected into us to, you go into a new space or you meet new people and we carry around stereotypes and we carry around assumptions. And whether we know it or not, we're kind of viewing the world through that.
Sure.
So the first thing I do is I try and check all of that at the door. Like, you know, it could literally be a door where you say to yourself before you walk in that door, like, leave all these notions, leave all these assumptions, leave all these stereotypes or whatever. Leave them here, right? Because you are going into a new space and you're meeting new people. And frankly, none of us are mind readers. So you don't know if somebody is has had, you know, the same upbringing as you, whether they appear that way or not. You don't know what's going on at home for them. You don't know how their morning started off. And you actually may have more in common with them than you realize, and vice versa. They may not realize they have as much in common with you. So that's probably my first thing, is to kind of go in almost tabula rasa, right? Like this is a clean slate first time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as we talked about in the beginning of the interview, go in with curiosity, go in with inquiry, wonder about things, ask questions. Now, if it turns into a place and an environment where you don't feel safe and you do not feel that belonging and it is absolutely not inclusive, get out of there.
Sure.
Like,
sure.
Absolutely. Call on your own tribe of people that you trust and say, hey, I'm not feeling, I'm not doing my best work here. I'm not feeling it. That's what community is about, right? That's why we create community, so that in those moments of hey, I'm not comfortable, I need an exit strategy, you can do that, right? And that's a great thing. We've talked about that here. We would never want anybody to be on a client site where they don't feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
We will absolutely support our people and say we're making changes, on behalf of that person. But I also think intentionally, we don't choose clients or choose business that results in that being the case. Now, sometimes there are things outside of our control, right? You cannot control every personality or every person, but I try and go in with that no assumptions start, and then you build up, right? It becomes like a little bit of a Lego, if you think of like the way you do Lego blocks. Yes, all the blocks are there individually. Do you necessarily know how people are going to stack them and what creation they're going to make? No.
Mm-mm.
So don't assume, right? Don't assume that they're going to take those Legos and turn them into something that it could be, could be used against you. Well, maybe they're going to turn it into something that becomes a tool for you, right? That makes you see things a different way and vice versa. So that's typically how I go into it, not to oversimplify it, but I've also been very fortunate, again, because of empathy. People see that in me, people feel that in me, and they want to get to know me as a person. And then slowly but surely they realize that I am a complex human being and I have lots of layers and stories, and not all of them align with people. That's okay. But I also never, I never sacrifice, who I am and what's important to me and my values. And, I'm unapologetically me. I hope that results in great business and great, client satisfaction. So far it has. But if it doesn't work out, I make changes.
I think that the attitude of just being unapologetically you,
mm-hmm,
is something a lot of us could use in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, if we go back to the stuff that's the data bombardment, the technology, right? I mean, you got to ask yourself, are you being unapologetically you, or are you on sort of a piloted path by something else, whether it's technology, whether it's, social media? Step back and really ask yourself that. Am I being true to me? And then enter the world.
And I've heard you're interested and an active participant in mindfulness meditation.
Very much so.
I'm sure that helps you step back a little bit. Feel a little bit less of that being driven by the world around you. Tell me a little bit about how you got into mindfulness meditation, why
Sure.
you enjoy it.
Yeah, my beginnings of this was probably, I think it's about maybe almost 4 years ago, if I'm doing the
Okay.
math in my head. It's so interesting because when you think about even the mindfulness journey, it's something that is almost timeless. So when you stop and say to yourself, how long have I been doing it? You catch yourself because it's not about how long you've been doing it, right? It's not something that's a start and an end. So you almost have to count a clock back and be like, when did I start it? But the reason I started it was I was in a place where I wanted a lot more creativity in my day to day, and I was frankly struggling with a lot of anxiety I wanted to spend more time in creativity and less time in anxiety. And I stumbled upon an app called Headspace that I've been using for a while. And it walked me through sort of the tenets of mindfulness. And I'm now, several years into that journey. And so meditation, I try and meditate twice a day for 20 minutes at a time. 20 minutes is a big chunk of time for most people to meditate. But you work up to it. And just by sort of starting my day and ending my day in that, what I do is you essentially clear your mind, and the mindfulness part comes in where you're not chasing your thoughts. And when you're not chasing your thoughts, you're being very present and in the world and in your body and in your mind. That's just it. Like there's no a set agenda. There's no desired outcome. There's a technique called noting where you sort of say, is that a thought or is that a feeling? So you can separate what you're experiencing and sensing versus what you're thinking versus what you're feeling. And it's important, I think, to note that, because most of the time our thoughts dictate what we do, not necessarily the other way around. So I try and, you know, understand how am I feeling? Like, what am I experiencing? What am I sensing? What's the sensation versus what's the thought? And just being able to separate those two can actually change your behavior and change the way that you walk into rooms, or more importantly, as you said, change the way that you go into, you know, and experience the world. So it's just that, just the ability to kind of work through that. And if I walk into a room, like you were saying, that it may not necessarily feel inclusive or appear inclusive, I stop and I ask myself, what am I feeling? You know, I don't say it out loud, it's all internal, but what am I feeling and what am I sensing? And more importantly, is that even mine, right? Like there's, again, with the empathy, and when you're empathetic or an empath, you actually pick up on other people's feelings and you experience them as if they were your own. So I wasn't really able to manage that and understand that until I got into meditation and mindfulness. And now a lot of times if I walk into a room and I pick up on a feeling or a sensation or an emotion, I'm actually able to sort of stop myself and say, hang on, is this even mine? Does this even belong to me? It may be somebody else's in this room or in this building or in this airplane, right?
Sure.
As we spend a lot of time on airplanes. It may not even be mine. And so there's small techniques that I've worked on. One I call return to sender, which is basically that. It's like, hang on a second. Is all of a sudden I got this bout of anxiety about this thing. Is this even mine? Like, I don't think it is. I think I might have just picked it up by walking by someone, or, you know, being aware or being, you know, empathic in a way. So I just return to sender, kind of like, it's not mine. So I don't need to work myself up or go through a bunch of anxiety or stress because this doesn't belong to me. So you know, on a simplified explanation, that's what it is for me. But it takes work. And it takes understanding how the human brain works and why. It takes understanding biochemistry. It takes understanding stimulus and triggers. And so going back to what we were saying, all the stuff that comes at you during the day and in the world, something I've put in place in addition to meditation and mindfulness is something I call Silent Saturdays. And I'll be embarking on one of these tomorrow, actually. It's my fourth one. Where I try and pick a Saturday where I don't speak for 24 hours.
24 hours. Yeah. That sounds extremely difficult.
And it's not as hard as some might think. Now, to be clear, it's not that I don't, you know, get any stimulus during the day. I listen to podcasts during the day. I read. I listen to music. But I intentionally and deliberately do not speak for 24 hours. And the reason I do this is because I find that if you are not trying to formulate thoughts in a way that you're about to speak, worried about how the words land, worried about how they might be interpreted, if you're not doing this sort of politicking and gaming that we do every single day in our lives, it's amazing what thoughts actually then stay in your mind and which thoughts leave your mind. So when you're not prologuing, if you will, and you're not prefacing, what is actually there? And it's a pretty amazing exercise to do. And I find it's very healing to do it. And it's amazing also, going back to the phone that we keep pointing at, you can do everything on your phone and you don't really have to speak. So it's kind of an exercise in reality. I can order food. I can you know, interact with the library. I can check books out and in. I can go buy things. I can interact entirely with the world and not say a word.
Wow.
And to me, that's great, right? Technology enabled that. But on the flip side, that's terrifying. Right?
It really is.
I can be a productive, interactive, you know, contributing member of society for 24 hours and not say a single word to a person is fascinating. But is it the right thing in retail? I don't know. Is it the right thing in the restaurant industry? I don't know. It just makes me wonder a little bit. So it's healing, and it's also leaves me wondering.
Wow, but that's really interesting. I actually never gave it that thought, that you could walk through an entire day and actually go through all your normal functions and have your normal life and not say a single word.
Go to the gym. Get a swim in. I mean, it was kind of an interesting log of sorts to say how many things can I do that actually don't require you to speak to a person.
Hmm.
And believe it or not, there are many things.
Wow, that's very interesting. So we talked about this a little bit, but about how there's a lot going on in the world, and there's a lot of change in politics, and there's many situations in everyday life and in the workplace where cultural sensitivity is not just important, but it's required.
Yeah.
It's required to have some sort of concept of that. So how do you go about change and change management with cultural sensitivity? How does that play in?
Yeah, it's a very well-timed question. I think every change management project and program is an exercise in cultural sensitivity, hands down. How you go about it, like, it's interesting because you don't necessarily see that in a methodology. You won't see that in a certification exam. But this goes back to what I was saying, the way I was raised and how I grew up in several countries and the way that my parents brought me and my siblings up, which is to be insatiably curious and to be humble and to ask questions from a place of genuine curiosity. And I try and apply the same thing when I'm helping organizations go through change. An organization is just another version of a culture. And you bring people, anytime you bring more than three people together, I think you're dealing with culture. It may look the same, it may feel the same, but it's still a culture. So the sensitivity part for me is it starts in understanding your stakeholders, for one. So, you know, to go back to a very, you know, practical example of change management, it always starts with stakeholder analysis. And you're literally analyzing the who's who of an organization. But it doesn't just stop there. It's not just who is Khalil and what is his role and how resistant is he to change.
Sure.
It could stop there. I might take it a little further and say, who is Khalil? What is his role? How resistant is he to change? And where does he come from? Or maybe not even where does he come from, but what is the sense of belonging to him? Or what are the books that he reads and why? You know, all of these things I'm asking from the standpoint of what informs Khalil's way of viewing the world. And, you know, the Khalil that comes into work versus the Khalil that, you know, goes home at the end of the day, I think should be the same person, should be unapologetically Khalil, right? Unfortunately, I think in work environments, a lot of people change that. They'll say, well, who I am outside of work is different than who I am inside of work. And that makes managing change very difficult regardless. So along the cultural sensitivities piece, I think that's the way I approach it is, change is just another language that I am still learning. And
you know a lot of languages.
And I know a few. But that's the part that I love about it is it requires me to study. It requires me to study people. It requires me to study their points of view. You can't necessarily go in and ask them about things political or religious or upbringing or any of that. That's okay. I think there's other ways to get to understand who the person is, not just who the professional is. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think it's very well timed because it's, you know, we see things around employee engagement and customer engagement. Those all deal with culture. Every single one of those deals with culture. But I think culture can sometimes be a scary word for people, especially in workplaces, mm-hmm. in organizations. So how do we get closer to that? How do we incorporate that? and managing change. I think that's a big piece. And I think we're going to see more of that going forward, because it's no different. Like a citizen or a consumer expects to be treated and viewed and interacted with in the way that they want based on how they view the world. I think it's going to be the same very, very shortly here in on how change is executed or managed or led in organizations.
Well, thanks, Bill.
You're welcome.
Thanks for bringing, helping bring that culture and that view of change and inclusion and diversity to West Monroe and to this podcast today. And
you're welcome.
Appreciate you, giving us your time and helping us be unapologetically ourselves.
Yeah, well, thank you for the idea, first of all, the idea to sort of flip the script and live the questions. Because I think it's the other piece is the best part about this is the questions you're asking don't have finite answers. And that's why I love that concept to do a tip to the On Being podcast I listen to a lot. Living the questions. I'm living these questions. And I love the idea that you said, hey, can we sit down and do this?
Sure.
So that others can benefit from it. It's great. So I appreciate the time, and I'm sure we'll do a follow up, and I hope other people have questions and can submit, and you get to do another one. So
of course. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Khalil.